DW, Living Planet, with Jordan Wilden.
Last week, the IPCC, or Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released a report on life at 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. That's just half a degree away from where we are now. In response, climate change has been thrust into the front of public conversation. This week on Living Planet, we're taking a closer look.
The climate challenge is so big that you need to use all the tools that you have in your toolbox. So you can put as many solar panels on all the cement factories around the world, you will still have very high emissions of CO2 from this industry. And the only solution that we know of today is to capture the CO2 and store it underground.
There's no easy solution to many of the climate issues we face. We can't just bury our problems underground. Or can we? A government-funded company in Norway is doing just that and hopes to develop a market for carbon capture. Meanwhile, we're being warned that climate change will also cause beer prices to shoot up. More on that later. But first, what's this 1.5 degree report all about? And what does it mean for everyday people like you and me? All this and more here on Living Planet. If you have any interest at all in the future of our planet, you'll have heard about the IPCC report on 1.5 degrees. I'm here with Sonia Dean, Environment Team Leader at DW, to help explain what this means. Sonia, what are the key takeaways from the IPCC report?
Well, it seems there is a much bigger difference in impact between 1.5 and 2 degrees of warming than was previously understood. That's basically the key finding of the UN scientific body. So we're talking about huge impacts on Earth systems that we as humans depend on. Take coral reefs, for example. Under 1.5 degrees of warming, we would still have some. They'd be reduced 70 to 90%, but they would still exist. But if you take 2 degrees, coral reefs would be all but wiped out. 99% would be gone, this report has said. So consider the impact of just this on people, for example, who make their living from the sea. Their food security would be at risk. It seems the end upshot is 1.5 is the new 2 degrees in terms of the global warming limit that we should be striving for.
Okay, and the report makes it clear that we need drastic societal-wide changes to achieve this. What would they look like?
We are talking about a massive transformation in virtually all of our systems. So, energy production, quickly scaling up renewables, leaving fossil fuels in the ground, particularly the dirtiest, like coal. We're talking about changes in land use, so more efficient agriculture, storing carbon in soils and in forests. Our buildings and our cities will need to become more energy efficient. Our transport systems will have to shift to e-mobility that's based on renewable energy. And we, of course, will have to change our consumption and waste habits. So, significant changes. And these would have to be made in the years and the decade to come, because this report projects that in order to keep the planet under 1.5 degrees Celsius, we'll have to slash our carbon emissions nearly in half by 2030. That's only 11 years away.
And what does that mean for everyday people like you and I, the people that are going about their daily business, worried about what's going to be happening based on this report and based on climate change in general?
Well, I think most importantly, do something. Don't just sit back, close your eyes, and pretend this isn't happening, because it is. And it's going to have a major impact in the future and on future generations. So there are a lot of things that you can do for the climate yourself. So eat less meat, avoiding air travel. Don't be a wasteful overconsumer. But probably the best thing that you can do is come together with others as a community and demand that governments implement policies to change these systems. That governments exit coal, that they leave fossil fuels in the ground, voting in politicians who prioritize climate protection and who resist the fossil fuel lobby, pressuring companies to divest from fossil fuels. The key thing is collective action. It's a very powerful thing and truly can make a difference.
DW's Environment Team Leader, Sonia Dean. If that isn't enough to make you want to take action, there's more at stake. Our quality of life in Europe could be considerably affected by declining yields of barley, meaning that beer, along with other luxuries, could go up in price. No longer can we, to quote the film Shaun of the Dead, go to the Winchester, have a nice cold pint, and wait for all of this to blow over. Anna-Sophie Brendlin, who reported on this story for us at DW.com, joins me now. Anna-Sophie, is beer being affected by climate change?
It sounds odd, right? But a new study found that increasingly severe and widespread droughts and heat could actually trigger a worldwide decline in yields of barley, and that's one of the main ingredients of beer. So that could obviously disrupt the global beer supply and cause severe shortages. Because to sum it up in a sentence, it means a shortage of beer, a fall in global beer consumption, and a rise in prices.
Okay, and how did the study come to that conclusion?
So it basically identified extreme climate events and modeled the impacts of these climate events on barley yields in 34 world regions, and the result revealed a potential average yield loss ranging from 3 to 17%, depending on the severity of the weather conditions. So what that means is basically the more heat and droughts we have, the less barley yields we have, which then results in less and more expensive beer.
And you say 34 regions, where would we see the biggest drop in consumption?
So that kind of depends on where you're from. China, which is currently the number one country when it comes to beer consumption by volume, is faced with a decline of roughly 10% of their current beer consumption, according to the study. In the US, it's even 20%, so I guess some Americans will have to say goodbye to games like beer pong and keg stands. And here in Germany, beer consumption could actually even decrease by roughly 30%, so that would make for a very different Oktoberfest, I suppose. And in the UK, consumption could fall by more than a third, so I'm not sure how you feel about that as a Brit.
I don't like the idea of that.
I can't imagine, yeah.
And what about the rising prices that you mentioned?
So the study found that beer-loving European countries would actually be hit the hardest by the high prices due to an average drop of 27 to 38% in the supply available for breweries in more extreme weather event years. I talked to the study coordinator and lead UK author. His name is Dabo Guan. He's a professor of climate change at the United Kingdom's University of East Anglia, and he had this to say.
In terms of relative change, the Eastern European countries, Estonia, Poland, and Czech Republic, their price going to change 6 to 7 times. So currently from roughly around 70 cents per bottle to $3.50 per bottle. Ireland is going to have the highest change in terms of the price change, absolute price change.
So you mentioned that Eastern European countries such as Estonia and Poland are going to be affected. Why is it the European countries in general are the most affected by the rise in prices?
Yeah, you'd wonder, right? Because these EU countries are known to brew a lot of beer and drink lots of beer, but they don't produce much beer quality barley. And so most of the barley is imported from other countries. So basically, changes in the global barley supply will affect the amount available for making beer in each region differently, because distribution of the grain for livestock feed, for brewing beer and other uses depends on region-specific prices.
Okay, and I'm looking for some optimism here. Have you spoken to anyone who has anything different to say about this?
Yeah, as a German, I was totally traumatized by this. I was like, no, there must be some good news. And I reached out to Markus Raupach. He's the owner of the German Beer Academy, which organizes events all about beer. And he agrees with the prognosis that climate change will cause a drop in barley yields, but he says there's alternatives.
In England,
there is currently a trend in England to cultivate and reintroduce old varieties of barley. These barley varieties won't produce a maximum yield, but they are very resistant when it comes to droughts and flooding. So you'll have an average annual yield which is relatively independent of the weather conditions and which will make it possible to better react to climate change.
The thing is, in Germany, we still have a little bit of a disadvantage. Here's Raupach again.
In Germany, we have a purity law that requires us to brew with barley. But in other countries, it's possible to just exchange barley with rice or maize. And once we are not dependent on the enzymes of barley malt anymore, because we can add them artificially, we could even refrain from using barley altogether.
Okay, and in the end, it's not just about beer, is it?
That's right. Climate change is not only having an impact on the alcoholic drink sector, it's said to affect world food production in general. And luxury goods, such as beer, may be the first to go when crops are needed to secure food supplies. The same goes for other luxury items, such as wine, tea, coffee, chocolate, so basically anything I live off, which will get more expensive or not available at all with increasing extreme weather events. And that's also the kind of message the study wants to spread.
Anna Sophie Brandlin, thank you for joining us. The IPCC report mentioned that renewables and reforestation will not be enough to limit global temperature rises. Carbon capture technology must also play an important part, they say. Such technology is extremely expensive and many projects have crashed in the past. But now there's renewed optimism among scientists and engineers in Norway. From there, Lars Bevanger reports.
Well, I'm at the biggest cement plant in Norway. Now, the cement industry is responsible for more than 5% of the world's total CO2 emissions. This plant is a part of the Heidelberg Group, which has a lot of plants around Europe and emits a whopping 70 million tons of CO2 a year. But this plant is about to do something about it.
My name is Per Brevik, Director of Sustainability and Alternative Fuels, Heidelberg Cement, Northern Europe. Here now, we are going to try to establish the first full-scale carbon capture plant for a cement industry. And then we will try to take out the CO2 from the flue gas, condition it, and then store it on the bottom of the North Sea.
The idea of removing CO2 from emissions to store it in porous rock under the seafloor is not new. Until now, though, it's been fraught with problems. It is extremely expensive, and critics have long argued carbon capture and storage, or CCS, is nothing but an excuse for the fossil fuel industry to carry on to the detriment of the growth of renewable alternatives.
Renewables is extremely important. But equally important is to do CO2 capture and storage because these industries don't have alternatives.
That's Trude Sundset, the CEO of Gassnova, the Norwegian state company responsible for finding CCS solutions for the future. While renewable energy production is growing fast, many industries, like cement production, will not be able to clean up their act without carbon capture technology, she argues.
The climate challenge is so big that you need to use all the tools that you have in your toolbox. So you can put as many solar panels on all the cement factories around the world, you will still have very high emissions of CO2 from this industry. And the only solution that we know of today is to capture the CO2 and store it underground.
Environment organisations in Norway agree. Olav Øye is from the Norwegian Bellona Foundation, which has worked with climate change issues for more than 30 years.
The other option is to shut down all cement plants, to shut down steel plants and shut down waste to energy plants. And I think there are very few politicians who are ready to argue for that. And if they do not argue for shutting down the plants, then they should really work a lot harder on getting CO2 capture and storage up and running.
This is where you do the magic, or you take out the CO2 and emit clean gas, where you take out normally between 80 and 95% of the CO2.
Engineer Odd Arne Vidsten shows me around the technology centre Mongstad near Bergen on Norway's west coast. It's the world's largest test facility for CO2 capture and key to what Gassnova hopes will bring about a CCS revolution. Technology developed here will help that cement plant clean its emissions. There's also, crucially, a plan to develop the infrastructure needed to transport and store the captured CO2. Sverre Overaar from Norway's state energy company Equinor is responsible for that bit.
The infrastructure is set up so that we actually come to the capture site and pick it up using ships, which is a very flexible means of transport because it can go more or less to anywhere where there is water. We transport it to our receiving facility on the west coast of Norway. And there we pump it out through a pipeline out into the North Sea and down 3,000 meters under the seabed into a porous rock formation where we store it.
Equinor has been using CCS at one of their natural gas platforms in the North Sea for more than 20 years. Just like the oil and gas, which has been locked in the rocks for millions of years, the CO2 also stays put once injected. If pilot projects involving onshore industries are realised, The plan is for Norway to become a CO2 storage centre for industries across Europe.
I think we're confident now there are really no technical barriers to developing CCS. It's about having access to infrastructure and the commercial models.
Luke Warren is from the Zero Emissions Platform, an interest organisation for CCS industry and research groups, which also advises the European Commission on the technology.
The next phase of their programme, which is developing the infrastructure to enable capture from multiple industrial sources, is really exciting. And I think if this project's realised, then there'll be opportunities for other sources of CO2 elsewhere in Europe to access the infrastructure here.
So if the technology exists and industries are keen to participate, why isn't CCS already widespread? It's the economy, stupid. In Europe, it costs less than 14 euro to emit 1 ton of CO2. That's far cheaper than implementing CCS, even if you're a massive polluter. The costs of taking that first step and develop a market and a working infrastructure for capturing CO2 will be astronomical. Many here argue that Norway, one of the world's richest countries with extensive offshore know-how, is in a unique position to take that lead. Lars Bevanger, DW, at the technology centre Mongstad near Bergen.
In 2009, the project Desert Tech proposed that with the right amount of technology, Europe and maybe the world's energy consumption could be generated by wind and solar power in the Sahara Desert. The project stumbled, but Morocco is hoping to move forward with renewable energy regardless.
These 300 mirrors direct the sunlight they receive to this tower. There, the sunlight is concentrated as if...
That was the late Gerhard Knies, physicist, pioneer and the brain behind Desert Tech.
Clean power from deserts can speed up the process of cutting emissions of carbon dioxide. At the same time, it can satisfy the growing energy...
You might have heard the name Desert Tech before. Knies calculated that the sun-rich deserts of the Middle East and North Africa could produce enough clean electricity to meet the world's energy needs 40 times over. His plan was for this sustainable power to be harnessed and transported to Europe. Major corporations, including Siemens and power companies RWE and E.ON, soon got on board, and the project known as Desert Tech Industrial Initiative, also called DII, was born. In 2010, Managing Director Paul Van Son declared that building pilot plants in North African countries like Morocco would make it possible to export solar power.
Within the project's first 10 years, you could certainly expect to see solar energy flowing from the deserts to Europe.
A combination of political, financial and technical complications mean those ambitious plans have been put on hold, for now. DII has downscaled from international mega initiative to consulting firm. But Morocco, meanwhile, is surging ahead with solar energy.
C'est très grand, c'est géant. Et là, on peut voir, vu d'ensemble de.
It's gigantic, shouts Youssef Stitou, an engineer for the Moroccan Agency for Renewable Energy. He's standing on the roof of the engine house at the Nor 1 solar power plant. The sun beats down from above. Below stretches a glittering expanse of almost 500,000 mirrors, with power generating capacity of 160 megawatts. It's part of the largest concentrated solar power complex in the world. Stitou says Morocco is aiming for 52% of its electricity to come from renewables by 2030. Some 9 years ago, King Mohammed IV announced a new path for the country, with sun, wind and water to be its main sources of power. Solar power, in particular, is playing a starring role in the energy revolution. The Nor 3 solar complex is expected to start generating power later this year. Further plants are also under construction. A huge solar complex is planned for Medelt in eastern Morocco, with up to 800 megawatts of installed capacity. People in this economically undeveloped area have high hopes for the project. Hassan Hadje is mayor of the town of Zaida in the Medelt region.
It's an enormous project. It'll boost economic momentum and, above all, solve the problem of unemployment. We'll be able to market our local products and services better. Our hotels and car rental companies will benefit from it.
That's the hope, at least. It's unclear just how many new jobs the project will bring or how much it'll boost the local economy. But Morocco is certainly taking the leap. The kingdom has put renewables and especially solar power at the top of its agenda. And now Tunisia and Algeria are planning major solar power projects too. Gerhard Knies's dream of bringing energy from the desert to Europe won't be a reality anytime soon. The green energy produced in Morocco has so far been completely consumed by the domestic market. But the German visionary may just have set something in motion with his desert tech idea.
That report was fired by Jens Borchers and was presented by Ruby Russell. Autumn is a wonderful time to enjoy the Alps, but this recent summer of heat has reminded us how fragile the alpine environment is. Social media was awash with shocking pictures of grey rocks where there once was ice. Meanwhile, scientists warn that due to a series of hot summers and mild winters, that high alpine permafrost cement is evaporating, making rocks unstable and prone to collapse. As we flock to the Alps for winter thrills or summer tours by car, we are impacting the environment. Could there be a way to enjoy the Alps without harming them? Christian Cummins went to Austria to find out.
Tyrol in early autumn. A ski lift takes hikers up to the high mountain pastures to enjoy the alpine nature. Yet the nature here is far from pristine. All around you see the pylons of other winter ski lifts and large swathes of concrete. Matthias Schickhofer, a conservationist, wildlife photographer and author of the book Schwarzbuch Alpen, or Black Book on the Alps, says that mass tourism has ruined parts of the mountain ecology.
Tourism in Austria is largely industrial tourism, which is heavily depending on infrastructure, cable cars, and big hotels and big roads and big parking areas and so on. And this also means that this is not really sustainable because it has a strong local impact.
It's the private cars that cause Schickhofer the most concern. They impact the famous alpine air quality, of course, but also the physical landscape of the mountains.
If people go there with car, they create noise. They leave all sorts of fine dust, of other kind of emissions there. They need infrastructure, which means they need big roads and big parking areas. And especially if you go up to this summer glacier skiing areas, it's looking like a shopping center in the Arctic.
Visit many famous alpine ski resorts in summer and autumn and you'll see bulldozers reshaping parts of the mountain to improve the winter ski runs, while the meadows are often discoloured where the winter ski runs have snaked down the mountain. By the side of these winter runs, you'll see the snowmaking machines, ever more ubiquitous in this era of rising snow levels. But by guaranteeing snow, even in warm weather, the resorts are also sacrificing something perhaps more valuable.
You have all the problems with artificial snow, because artificial snow has to be stored in ponds, and from there it's then sprayed on the slopes. And there's heavy pollution, because it's river water used mainly to produce this artificial snow, and this is contaminated by bacteria. So in some areas in France, the clear streams coming down from the mountains are not drinkable anymore, and people have to be serviced with water from a tank. I think these are warning signs that this is the wrong direction.
What we're looking at here, warn conservationists, is a vicious circle. The resorts are threatened by climate change, so they're reacting by building new lifts higher up the mountain or clubbing together and building connecting lifts between resorts and then building more energy-gobbling snow machines, all things which, of course, increase emissions and degrade nature.
It's industrial landscape. It's not alpine landscape anymore. And I think it's time to start thinking about a plan B, which is not so much depending on snow, which is not so much depending on this sort of mass tourism, but more focusing on quality and on nature. And I think this is a general trend. And I think this will be the future of tourism in the Alps.
There are prototypes of how such a plan B could look, and I've come by train to look at one. From Salzburg station, I've changed to the small alpine town of Bischofshofen, about 45 kilometres down the valley. Here, for free, I'm being picked up by a shuttle by the small resort of Werfenweng, which wants people to arrive without their cars, and when they get to the resort, to move around and enjoy themselves as carbon neutrally as possible. I'll get into this shuttle waiting for me here and go and meet the mayor, Peter Brandauer, who calls his concept
SAMO?
SAMO means sanfte Mobilität or gentle mobility. We try to encourage as many guests as possible to travel in an environmental friendly way. That starts with the arrival. They come in by train or by bus. And in the village itself, there are sustainable options, electric cars to hire or shuttle services. If you arrive by train or bus, or if, as a car driver, you hand in your keys at the tourist office, you get a SAMO card.
This card means you can enjoy carbon light activities for free, such as horse cart rides, llama walks, or in winter cross-country skiing. And for 10 euros you can borrow all sorts of fun ways to get around the village without a car. Abandoning your private vehicle should feel like a liberation, not a sacrifice. Susanne Verhoest, a Dutch woman who's been working at Werfenweng for the past 5 seasons, is standing behind a counter renting them out. Golf carts, segways, rollers. I ask her how important personally the environmental aspect is.
Yeah, it would be silly not to be important. Of course it is. And it's nice to see the people that come from the cities. They come here. At the start of the week, they're still full with stress. And you see later on in the week, they calm down and they take over that laid-back attitude and enjoy just driving around with the electric vehicles.
This development has won over the local population, many of whom use the free shuttles themselves and benefit from the quiet environment. And there's an outside heated swimming pool you can see, as well as the snow machines on the mountains. The amount of guests arriving by public transport has risen from 6% when the project began in 1997 to 25% now, but that still means three quarters arrive in their private cars. Time is ticking. The problems are large scale, whilst the solutions are small scale. Mattia Shikova says a few ecologically aware villages can't, of course, tackle an addiction to the private car. That needs a concerted political policy change.
The problem is that the mainstream of politics is still heading in the wrong direction. Yeah, they're still going for motorways, they're still going for big shopping centres. This is creating a situation where people are dependent on cars, and this is supporting the addiction of people.
Yet Matthias is still hopeful. He sees a bottom-up change coming that could help marry alpine conservation and a sustainable and flourishing tourism industry.
I think there is a growing trend, people also as a reaction on digitalization and urbanization, that people are looking for the analog experience, for nature experience and for contemplation more and more. And I think there's a big chance for the Alps. The Alps are cooler. They have beautiful landscape, and you can come down there. There are even places where you don't have net signal, and that's a big advantage.
Christian Cummins for DW Austria.
The future is uncertain, but I think that's a positive. It still means that we have time to make an impact. You've been listening to Living Planet. Our programme was produced with the help of Ileana Giladucci and Michelle Springer. I'm Jordan Wildon. In the next 2 weeks on Living Planet, we have a special on what happens if we don't take action and if the world reaches 3 degrees higher. Until then.